This is On Point. I'm Anthony Brooks, in for Meghna Chakrabarty. For the first time ever, a former American president is facing criminal indictment. Manhattan District Attorney Alvin Bragg has been investigating Donald Trump over an alleged hush money payment to adult film star Stormy Daniels, and he appears to be close to charging the former president. Republicans have come to Trump's defense. Here's Ohio Congressman Jim Jordan, who says the prosecution by District Attorney Bragg, a Democrat, is political.
Even Alvin Bragg wouldn't bring it a year ago, and he didn't decide to bring it until President Trump announces he's running for president. And then, oh, now we're going to go after the leading guy, the guy who's winning in the polls, leading in the polls. Now we're going to go after him because the left says I should. That is selective prosecution, and the country understands that.
Jordan and other House Republicans have demanded that Bragg turn over his records to them. Bragg's office shot back, calling that demand an unprecedented and unlawful interference into a state investigation. In addition to a likely indictment in New York, Trump is under investigation in Fulton County, Georgia, for possible election interference. He also faces two federal investigations, one of them looking into his alleged attempts to thwart the peaceful transfer of power after he lost the 2020 election, the other into his possession of classified documents and other presidential material after he left the White House. Trump is urging his supporters to protest should he be indicted, and says he'll stay in the 2024 presidential race no matter what. So what do we know about Trump's potential indictment so far? And what legal and political implications would the indictment of a former president have? Well, to start us off this hour, I'm happy to welcome Andrea Bernstein. She covers Trump legal cases for NPR and is a member of ProPublica's democracy team. She's also the author of American Oligarchs, The Kushners and the Trumps and the Marriage of Money and Power. She co-hosted the podcast Will Be Wild and Trump, Inc. Andrea, welcome back to On Point. Thanks so much for being with us.
Great to talk to you, Anthony.
From what you know, let's just start with a really basic question. Is Trump definitely going to be indicted?
Nothing is certain here. I mean, what is so unusual about this situation is that grand jury proceedings in New York are secret, and it is illegal for prosecutors to discuss them. In fact, it's the same level of crime that the crime that we understand that is being considered regarding former President Trump. They're both e-felonies. So we actually just cannot know until something is public. And Alvin Bragg, the DA, has made clear, including as recently as yesterday, that he will inform the public whether he decides to bring no charge, or the grand jury decides to bring no charge, or there is an indictment, in which case it's unclear how we would learn something. Typically what happens is that an indictment is filed under seal. The defendant is notified. Arrangements are made for the defendant to turn themselves in. And we don't officially know, we in the press and the public, until the indictment is unsealed at a court appearance. So that's the usual proceeding. Of course, nothing is usual about this case.
Right. Nothing is usual indeed. But let's talk about what we know. I mean, we know that Bragg's office has brought in lots of witnesses before the grand jury. We know that he offered Trump a chance to testify. Isn't that a pretty clear signal that an indictment is forthcoming? I mean, that's why there's been so much speculation that it is coming, right?
Well, as the eight ball would say, signs point to yes.
Right.
But again, we just actually don't know. I mean, one of the things that's very unusual about this case is that you see witnesses. Michael Cohen has been speaking about his testimony. A rebuttal witness that was offered by the president's team, Robert Costello, who was briefly Michael Cohen's attorney, has been talking about his testimony. Other witnesses have been seen going in and out. Kellyanne Conway, Hope Hicks, both political advisors to the former president. Executives at the Trump Organization. This is being closely watched in a way that grand juries in New York really usually are not. And the other thing that is quite unusual about this is because there was a federal prosecution, the prosecution of Michael Cohen back in 2018, many of the facts surrounding this case are already a matter of public record. So we understand, for example, based on prosecution memos and documents and Michael Cohen's remarks when he was appearing in court for his guilty plea and for his sentencing, that there payments were made to him, that first he made these payments on his out of his own bank account after he took out a loan to get it. Ms. Clifford, a.k.a. Stormy Daniels, in the waning days of the 2016 campaign, in order to purchase her silence. We know from these same court documents that Trump's business came to a deal to reimburse Mr. Cohen and to call these reimbursement payments retainer for legal fees, which clearly they were not. We know from documents that Mr. Cohen put into the public record when he testified to Congress in 2019 that Donald Trump himself signed some of these checks, that they came from his personal bank account. So all this we know. And what we don't know, and what the district attorney is looking into right now, is was Mr. Trump's personal involvement in this arrangement a crime? And that is the matter that is being examined. And it's a really, well, it's not uncommon in New York for there to be prosecutions based on falsifying business records, which is what is being looked at here. It is a felony in New York if the falsification takes place in furtherance of another crime, mm-hmm. which doesn't actually mean there was another crime. It just means it was meant to cover up something. That's what is under question here, right. And we just won't know until we see the court documents or not.
And furtherance of another crime in this case could be covering up campaign finance spending, correct?
It could be making an illegal campaign finance an illegal donation under campaign finance laws. Now, we don't know really. I mean, we know that in the federal case, Michael Cohen pleaded guilty to violating federal campaign finance law, to wit, making a donation in excess of the allowable campaign limits under federal law. But what we don't know is how New York state law could connect to federal law, or whether there is perhaps a New York law, or whether the district attorney is looking at something else entirely non-campaign finance related. I mean, one of the reasons, I should say, is that we do know some of the internal details of the DA's deliberation on this case is because Mark Pomerantz, who was hired by the previous Manhattan District Attorney, Cyrus Vance Jr., wrote a book in which he really went deep into some of the DA's internal deliberations. So we've really had the curtain pulled back in a way that is extremely, extremely unusual in New York grand jury investigations.
Really interesting. So we know a few days back, Trump tweeted that he was going to be arrested this past Tuesday. Obviously, that didn't happen. But what do we know in terms of sort of what's next on the calendar? If an indictment is coming, when it might come? Go ahead.
So we do know that the grand jury meets Mondays, Wednesdays, and Thursdays. So no meeting today. We know that it did not meet on Wednesday. We know that it did meet on Monday and questioned Mr. Costello, the former attorney who briefly represented Michael Cohen. And for those who are following along at home extremely closely, there was a set of emails that were released in the Mueller report in which during the time that all of this was becoming public in 2018, Robert Costello emailed Michael Cohen to the effect of, "Sleep well tonight. The boss loves you, and you have friends in high places." Hmm. So that was sort of the kind of last time that Robert Costello emerged in connection with this case. Now, he is saying that he doesn't believe Michael Cohen. Michael Cohen has no credibility, that he has documents to prove that. So all of that is something that is still being sorted through. The grand jury is expected to meet again on Monday. What the other thing I think is really clear, just from having covered these Trump cases in New York. So when Alan Weisselberg, Trump's former CFO, was indicted in New York, what happened was that there was an indictment. There were, subsequent to the sealed indictment, private negotiations between Mr. Weisselberg's legal team and the district attorney. And we didn't officially learn anything was going to happen until it was unsealed, although we understood word sort of began to emerge about when Mr. Weisselberg was going to turn himself in, which was early in a summer morning, and he turned himself in. His fingerprints were taken, his prints were processed and sent to Albany, and then in the afternoon of that day, he was basically walked from the DA's office to the courtroom, which is actually in the same building. They sort of have different entrances, but they're in the same building. So he emerges from the elevator. He walks down the hallway. There are all these sort of famous images of him in handcuffs, passing television reporters, surrounded by security, and then he's walked into the courtroom. The logistics of that for a former president are really different because obviously the press and the public have a right to access to a court proceeding. But normally, when you cover a former president, there is some interaction with the Secret Service. They want information about who was there. There are security needs. So the idea of you just kind of show up at court at the crack of dawn and wait to be let in and line up in a hallway and then this defendant is taken by you is something that, from everything I can understand, and I don't know this officially, so I'm sort of reading tea leaves here, is something that the authorities in New York are still trying to figure out. How do you balance all of that, and which is a completely unprecedented situation? And then you add to that the former president's really, high decibel social media posts about destruction and chaos and catastrophic results if he's arrested or prosecuted. So all of this is something that no one has ever done before, and that seems to me to be contributing to the uncertainty about what comes next.
Lots of uncertainty. Andrea Bernstein, stay with us. We're going to pick up with you after the break. We're discussing the potential indictment of former President Donald Trump, the legal and the political ramifications of something that is unprecedented in American history. Stay with us. I'm Anthony Brooks. This is On Point.
Support for the On Point podcast comes from Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform that lets you find candidates fast. Ditch the busy work and use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/on point. That's Indeed.com/on point. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
This is On Point. I'm Anthony Brooks. We're talking today about Donald Trump's potential indictment for his alleged hush money payment to porn actress Stormy Daniels in 2016. This could be the first time a former president is charged with a crime, and we're trying to understand the case surrounding Trump today. We're joined by reporter Andrea Bernstein. She covers Trump legal cases for NPR and is a member of ProPublica's democracy team. And Andrea, before the break, we were sort of talking about the kind of chaos, the sort of usual chaos of the Trump show, if you will. You've covered Trump and his legal challenges for a long time. He's already survived multiple federal investigations, two impeachment trials, lots of predictions of his political demise. What are you observing about how the former president is responding to all this now?
Well, as he usually does, he has our attention. The sort of way these things are playing out now is that the information is coming from the target of the investigation. And, you know, this happened, it played out last summer when he said he had been raided by the FBI at Mar-a-Lago. I mean, I think the more accurate word is Mar-a-Lago was searched.
Right. These were classified documents that went from the White House and ended up in Mar-a-Lago.
Yes, exactly. And, you know, that case is also coming to a head, you know, right now, potentially this week. They're sort of bringing in, you know, high-level witnesses, Trump's one of his attorneys. So in this case, you know, he sort of stirred everybody up last Saturday morning early with an early Saturday morning tweet or post on social media in which he, said he was going to be arrested. I think that conjures up images of, you know, people coming to his home at Mar-a-Lago, dragging him out in handcuffs. not usually what we're looking at with a white-collar defendant here. And I think, you know, in the context of this sort of vacuum of information, he is the one speaking, as well as, you know, his allies in the Republican Congress. They are sort of filling this information void. But, you know, unfortunately, we just have to wait. I think one of the things that's quite interesting about this is the Trump v. Vance, the Trump investigation in New York began in 2018. So 5 years ago. And, excuse me, and Trump's legal team resisted this at every turn. They kept they sued the former district attorney. They said he had no right to have access to records. They said a president is absolutely immune from prosecution. You may remember there was a famous remark by one of Trump's lawyers in the Second Circuit Court of Appeals that, in fact, a president could shoot somebody on Fifth Avenue and not even be investigated for it. This went all the way to the Supreme Court. The Supreme Court rejected that argument and sent it back to the lower courts to work out, but Trump's legal team still wouldn't turn over the documents, so it went back up to the Supreme Court, and it wasn't until after Trump was president that they got these documents. So that was years of delay in the investigation. All of this might have been concluded much more quickly had that not happened. So now we are in this situation where Donald Trump is running for president again, and the DA only now has been able to put together a case, possibly, that we will be seeing soon. So the delay, the timing, has really more to do with how the former president's legal team delayed this than it does with sort of this charge that the DA waited around until Trump was running and then struck.
Right, right. Important context there. So speaking of response by Republicans, House Republicans have accused District Attorney Bragg of waging a political vendetta against Trump and have said that if Trump is indicted, they will investigate Bragg. In fact, they've already demanded that he turn over records and phone logs and so forth. Can you tell us about that and how DA Bragg has responded?
Yeah, so this is really, you know, just a sort of another piece of uncharted territory here. You know, the House and these various committees are usually investigating the federal government, not what local prosecutors are doing. But that is what they've done here. And what the DA said in a letter to Congress yesterday was, you are going to be interfering with local law enforcement if, you know, you seek these records. That is a completely inappropriate role, which is a real sort of turnaround that the Republicans are being charged with the ones who are interfering the enforcement of the law. But that is sort of the moment at which we've arrived. This has been a constant line of attack, both in these New York cases and in every case with Donald Trump, but very much in the New York cases, the president, former president, he was president when this started, now former president. His legal team has charged political, political, political. It has been rejected by every court, up to and including the U.S. Supreme Court. There is a parallel civil case in New York where Trump's legal team has made the same charge, also rejected by a judge who said the political orientation of the prosecutor or the investigator does not matter here. What matters are the facts and the law. Donald Trump's company was convicted back in December of 17 felonies by a jury. That is not a sort of, you know, political prosecutor just kind of throwing a wrench in the work. So I think if you look at the actual legal record, it refutes all of that. But I certainly don't expect to hear that argument retired anytime soon.
Finally, Andrea, before we let you go, what happens next? What are you sort of on the edge of your seat watching over the next, I don't know, 72 or so hours? What's the next step?
Well, I hope we have a more peaceful weekend than last one in terms of chasing down stories. The grand jury comes back on Monday, so far as we know, although it is, once again, secret. So we will know when we know. If it comes back, I understand from former prosecutors that the way it goes is that there has to be a careful charge made to the grand jury, because this is something that defendants are really looking at. Was the grand jury properly charged? They don't have to conclude beyond a shadow of a doubt, beyond any reasonable doubt, that the former president committed a crime, but they have to believe that the evidence suggests a crime was committed. It doesn't have to be a unanimous grand jury. It has to be the majority of the grand jury. So there's a very careful presentation of charges. There is a deliberation by the grand jury, and that is really out of anybody's hands. That could take, you know, a short amount of time, or it could take days. It's possible that the grand jury will ask to see other witnesses. But assuming if still a possibility, if the grand jury votes, the next thing would be to enter that indictment into court. That would be sealed, and that could theoretically happen in a day. It could happen over the course of a week. Again, we just don't know. But once that happens, the defendant is notified. And the prosecution, or the grand jurors and the court can't talk about it, but the defendant can. So it's possible that if something happens, we would learn it from the former president. Now, again, we don't know, ? It's a secret grand jury proceeding. We'll know when we know.
All right. We'll know when we know. And Andrea Bernstein will be there to help us sort it all out. She covers Trump legal cases for NPR, and she's a member of ProPublica's democracy team. Andrea, thank you so much for joining us today. We really appreciate it.
Thank you.
Let me introduce Ryan Goodman. He's professor of law and co-director of the Reese Center on Law and Security at New York University School of Law. He's also the co-editor-in-chief of Just Security. Professor Goodman, welcome to On Point. It's great to have you.
It's great to be here with you.
Also joining us is On Point News analyst Jack Beattie from Hanover, New Hampshire. Jack, it's always good to have you. Thanks for being with us.
Hello, Anthony.
Jack, I'll start with you as we listen to Andrea lay out some of the complexity of what's going on. What are you thinking about? And specifically, talk a little bit about Alvin Bragg and the situation he finds himself in here.
Well, he finds himself in the situation of being abused at new depths of iniquity by Mr. Trump. Just this morning, Trump posted, calls him human scum, a degenerate psychopath. Yesterday he called him an animal. We have to remember that Mr. Bragg is an African-American. The New York Times called that racist language. Yes, it's also racist inciting language. That almost certainly means that Mr. Bragg has to watch his step in New York from crazed Trump supporters. Trump this morning also goes on to warn of the potential, quote, death and destruction in bringing such a false charge could be a catastrophe for our country. This from a man still approved by 70% of Republican voters. But there's some reason to think that he might have found his match in Alvin Bragg, 49, Harvard graduate, Harvard Law School graduate, former federal prosecutor and deputy New York State Attorney General, who's had Trump in his sights for some time and Trump people. He secured a 6-count indictment of Steve Bannon for fleecing millions from a sucker scheme on the building a wall. He secured a conviction of Alan Weisselberg for 15 felony counts. He was the chief financial officer of Trump Organization. And as the assistant New York attorney general, he oversaw, Bragg did, litigation against the Trump Organization. He said this about himself during the 2020 campaign. This is Alvin Bragg. Growing up in Harlem, I saw every side of the criminal justice system from a young age. Before I was 21, I had a gun pointed at me 6 times, 3 by police officers and 3 by people who were not police. I had a knife to my neck, a semi-automatic gun to my head, and a homicide victim on my doorstep. He says to his office in a message today about the Trump pressure, we do not tolerate attempts to intimidate and threaten the rule of law in New York. He's not a man who seems to be easily intimidated with that biography.
Really interesting. Ryan Goodman, we wanted you on the show to give us some sort of legal background to this whole case and trying to understand the legal implications. But pick up on what Jack said about Alvin Bragg in the sense that here's Trump. He's already survived multiple federal investigations, a couple of impeachment trials, lots of predictions about his political demise. Jack said with Alvin Bragg, he might have met his match. What do you think? What are you seeing?
So I think he very well might have. And Alvin Bragg, it appears, has been very cautious in a certain sense of knowing when to bring cases when they're ready. So he was given the option of bringing these cases involving the hush money scheme and potentially the false statements to banks that Trump is alleged to have engaged in when he first came into the office in January, February of 2022. This is according to the Mark Pomerantz book, where Pomerantz and another senior prosecutor essentially say to Bragg, we want you to bring it now. And if you don't, we're resigning, and we're resigning loudly. And Bragg says, it's not ready, which I think is to his great credit. And now it looks like he thinks this, at least a big part of it, is ready. And the charge that's being reported, the one that's at the center of this that Andrea talked about, is the felony falsification of business records. And that does seem like a very strong case that he has based on what's in the public record. The big question I do think, though, is what is the second crime that it's, quote unquote, in furtherance of? That's what makes it a felony. And
Ryan,
that
can
will
you
be
spell that out a little bit? Because, you know, while the catalyst for this investigation is paying money to a former porn star to buy her silence about an alleged affair with Mr. Trump, an affair that Trump denies, that in itself is not the potential crime, right? So be very clear and explain what the crime is that we're talking about here.
That's right. So the crime is a falsification of business records. The facts that match that offense are that the scheme involved reimbursing Michael Cohen for having done the payoff. So Michael Cohen pays Stephanie Clifford, otherwise known as Stormy Daniels, $130,000 for her story so that they can suppress it before the election and it won't come out. He's then reimbursed by Trump. And we have Trump's signature on many of these checks that we have photographs of. The reimbursement, they classify it as legal services. That is the scheme that Trump, Cohen, and Alan Weisselberg, the CFO of the Trump Organization, devised, therefore entering it into the business records as false invoices. Another thing they say is it's according to in their invoices, they say it's because of the legal retainer with Michael Cohen. And the federal court filings by the Justice Department say there was no legal retainer. And Trump was aware of the fact of what it was for, which is a payment to Stormy Daniels. It is not legal services that Michael Cohen was providing. So it's almost basically a slam dunk on falsification of business records. But what I've just described is only a misdemeanor. It becomes a felony, separate felony offense, if the falsification of those business records was done in furtherance of committing or concealing a second crime.
I see.
That's what I'm looking for. What is going to be that second crime in all likelihood that we'll see if there is an indictment?
Right. Some have suggested that of the four investigations that Trump is facing, one in Fulton County, Georgia, and two federal probes, this is perhaps the least serious. And therefore, it's perhaps unfortunate that this is the first one to result in charges. But you wrote a piece recently in the New York Times that's headlined, "Make No Mistake, the Investigations of Donald Trump and Stormy Daniels Scheme is Serious." Can you talk a little bit about that?
So what we try to place as the argument is that it is kind of a false comparison to look at the other crimes that Trump is alleged to have engaged in, which are definitely more serious. Some of those are like the crime of the century, trying to interfere with a peaceful transfer of power. But rather, what prosecutors will do and what we as a public, we suggest, should do is compare whether or not Trump's alleged crimes in the Alvin Bragg hush money payments are similar to what the district attorney's offices across New York regularly prosecute. So that's what prosecutors do. They want to see, are we treating like cases alike? We do not want to be unfairly targeting Trump for things that would otherwise not be prosecuted.
I see.
So what we did is a survey of all of the cases that have been prosecuted for falsification of business records over the last 15 years, and we find it's very common. And in fact, many of the allegations or what people are convicted for is far below the seriousness for which Trump is being potentially charged.
Interesting. So this would be a response to the partisan criticism that this is an example of selective prosecution by a Democratic DA targeting a former Republican president. You're saying that, in fact, there have been lots of routine prosecutions along these lines leading up to this case.
Exactly, and that it would be special treatment to let him off the hook in a certain sense. It's not special treatment to charge him with the crime.
Really,
other people would be charged.
Really interesting. We're talking about the legal case around Donald Trump's potential indictment and the national implications such a decision could have. Jack Beatty is with us. Ryan Goodman is with us. More after the break. I'm Anthony Brooks. This is On Point.
Did you kill Marlene Johnson?
I think you're one of the first people to have actually asked.
From WBUR and ZSP Media, this is Beyond All Repair, a new podcast about an unsolved murder that will leave you questioning everything.
Somebody should be in jail for murdering my sister.
A woman who's never been believed.
As long as they think I have done this, then they're not looking for who actually did this.
And that's what makes it a cold case.
No, it's a botched case.
And a search for the truth, once and for all.
Wow, it just gets more interesting.
Beyond All Repair. Listen and follow wherever you get your podcasts.
Be careful. You're digging in a place that's been very peaceful for a while.
Do it anyway. Dig.
This is On Point. I'm Anthony Brooks. We're talking today about the potential indictment of former President Donald Trump, the legal and political ramifications. With us are On Point news analyst Jack Beatty and Ryan Goodman. He's professor of law and co-director of the Reese Center on Law and Security at New York University School of Law. And Ryan, Jack, before the break, Ryan, you were making the point that it was a good pushback to the idea that this is a selective and political prosecution on the part of Alvin Bragg, that in fact he's taking on, that there's a lot of precedent for going after folks for cases like this, even less serious ones. Let me start with you, Jack. Still, by possibly indicting a former president, Bragg is taking the country, really, into a whole new territory. We've never been here before. So I'm curious how you're thinking about that and to what extent you can, speculate about how Bragg might be thinking about that. I'd like to ask you both that. But Jack, let me start with you.
Well, you're right. We haven't been there before. We've been close. After he left office in early August 1974, Richard Nixon was certain that he was going to be indicted for bribery, obstruction of justice, and other matters by a federal grand jury, but President Ford's pardon took that off the boards. When he was leaving office, Bill Clinton looked ahead to being charged in a perjury, being charged with perjury in the Paula Jones trial, but he worked out a deal with his star prosecutor to. You know, he would surrender his law license and pay a fine. Those were close calls. This is even closer. What it could mean for Bragg, I don't know. What he's thinking, I don't know. I think I've pointed in his biography that there's some steel in his background, and but there are complications. And one of them, I want to ask Ryan about this. Mark Pomerantz, you mentioned him. He's the prosecutor who quit very publicly when Mr. Bragg didn't go ahead with the indictment of Trump a couple of years ago. In his book, Pomerantz says that Bragg didn't want to go ahead. One of the reasons he didn't want to go ahead was that he didn't want to use Michael Cohen as a witness. He didn't think he was a credible witness. Well, in this current case, Michael Cohen is going to be the star witness. So is that Pomerantz revelation a big stumbling block for the prosecution?
So I do think it's one of the complications that The star witness is a complicated person who can be challenged for having not only committed crimes, I mean a felon, but crimes including lying, lying to Congress and the rest. So it is a way in which the prosecutors are going to need to corroborate his testimony. And it's not unusual for prosecutors. I mean, prosecutors oftentimes are going to prosecute, you know, members of organized criminal activity, and they're going to want to have accomplices who they flip and then have them on the witness stand. And those are not going to be the, you know, the most innocent characters. They themselves might have had criminal jeopardy and flipped and pled guilty to a whole bunch of crimes that they say, I engaged in these crimes with the defendant, and that is the situation. So the crimes that Michael Cohen pleaded to include the very same nucleus of facts as this one. But there are, you know, there's a lot of corroboration. I think that might be the reason that they feel they can go forward. There's the checks, you know, there are 11 checks. Most of them are signed by Trump himself. There's the audio recording of Michael Cohen with Trump discussing the hush money payment scheme and referring to the arrangement with Alan Weisselberg and referring to the arrangement with the National Enquirer. Trump suggesting let's pay it in cash. Trump names the amount, and Michael Cohen says, I'm going to set up a company, which is a shell company, to do it. And the federal prosecutors were also able to get a non-prosecution agreement out of the National Enquirer's parent organization, American Media Inc., which says this was the scheme and we did it to suppress these kinds of stories coming out before the election. That's a bunch of corroboration. I do think, you know, one big question for me is Alan Weisselberg. Might he testify? There could be a lot of pressure on him because he still has a lot of legal jeopardy that he's in. And that would potentially shift it. And I could imagine that might shift it because since Pomerantz left office, that has been a large part of the activity of Alvin Bragg with respect to Alan Weisselberg, who is currently in Rikers Island. And that is the time in which people sometimes do decide my best fate is to cooperate with the authorities.
Ryan, I'm still intrigued by this question because, I mean, obviously a prosecutor like Alvin Bragg is considering the sort of sacred principles that we're all equal under the law. But to what extent does a prosecutor like Bragg take into consideration that we're dealing with a former president here and leading the country into new territory?
I think it's a he is in a difficult situation, and I think he has to consider the context. And the reason I say difficult, because at one level, it's easy to say, as we do in law school, as I teach in my classes, nobody is above the law. The U.S. Supreme Court has reaffirmed this principle time and again. It did so in the United States v. Nixon case with Nixon's tapes. It did so in the Clinton v. Paula Jones case. They say it specifically. We just saw it happen again with the 11th Circuit Court of Appeals in Georgia, which is a conservative bench, and they said on the Mar-a-Lago declassification documents, a former president does not get special treatment. That's former presidents and incumbent presidents. At the same time, there is a concern that the government and the law enforcement agencies could ever be used to be weaponized against political opponents. So if indeed one is going after a former president from a different party who is a leader of the political opposition in a certain sense, that has to give him pause. I do think it means that if he brings a case, he's going to have much greater confidence in it than other cases. He's only going to bring it if he thinks he can really win it, and if he doesn't have just a slim majority of that grand jury, but a you know, sizable majority of that grand jury, if not unanimous.
All right. Well, that's Ryan Goodman. He's professor of law and co-director of the Reese Center on Law and Security at New York University School of Law. He's also the co-editor-in-chief of Just Security. Professor Goodman, thanks so much for joining us today. It was great having you.
Thank you so much.
And still with us, Jack Beatty, On Point News analyst. And I want to introduce Jeff Cabaservis. He's the vice president of political studies at the Niskanen Center, a center-right think tank in Washington. Jeff, welcome to On Point. It's good to have you.
Hello, Anthony. It's good to be here.
We wanted to sort of pivot this final part of the conversation to the political implications of what's happening. And let me just start there with a brief question. We've got a presidential campaign ongoing. President Trump says he's in it no matter what, come hell or high water or indictments. How does this affect the sort of political universe that we find ourselves in right now?
Well, you know, Anthony, I do believe that the judicial system should be allowed to carry out its own course. But I also believe with former Republican Representative Peter Meyer that an indictment would be, in effect, giving Trump $1 billion worth of free publicity. And I think there's no doubt that even the threat of the indictment has also already allowed Trump to vault to the top of the Republican presidential primary sweepstakes for 2024. And in effect, even people who oppose Trump in the Republican Party have been forced to rally around him and say that this is a rigged judicial proceeding, that Democrats are weaponizing the institutions of government and the rule of law against Trump.
Well, let's hear a little bit of tape on that point. On Saturday, Senator Lindsey Graham of South Carolina said the ongoing probe is probably going to help Donald Trump's prospects for 2024. Here's what he said.
Here's what I think is going to happen. The prosecutor in New York has done more to help Donald Trump get elected president than any single person in America today.
And on Monday, Florida Governor Ron DeSantis sort of played it down the middle. He criticized Manhattan District Attorney Alvin Bragg, but he also took a bit of a swipe at Trump's at the legal predicament that Trump finds himself in.
I don't know what goes into paying hush money to a porn star to secure silence over some type of alleged affair. I can't speak to that. But what I can speak to is that if you have a prosecutor who is ignoring crimes happening every single day in his jurisdiction, and he chooses to go back many, many years ago to try to use something about porn star hush money payments, you know, that's an example of pursuing a political agenda and weaponizing the office.
So a couple of Republican voices there. And Jeff, you know, they would sort of support this idea that you suggest that this is going to help him. But isn't it true that while it may help him in the short term, in the long run, a presidential campaign, I'm going to argue that it's not going to be helped by an indictment. It might excite his base, but that's not enough to get him back to the White House. He needs moderate Republicans. He needs independents who've already shown that they've been turned off by the perpetual chaos of the Trump show. Doesn't this sort of add to that chaos and turn those moderates away?
I think you're right. But I also think that chaos is Trump's brand, and he's used it successfully in the past. You know, I really have felt in these hyper-partisan, polarized times that we're reverting to our tribal status. And Trump is the tribal leader of the Republican Party. And really, I think when most people are in that kind of tribal mindset, then their beliefs and values and principles go out the window. And the only one that remains is loyalty to the tribal leader. I was struck by a poll that the Public Religion Research Institute has conducted over a number of years with white evangelicals. And the poll asked whether they believed that an elected official who commits an immoral act in their personal life can still behave ethically and fulfill their duties in public and professional life. And in 2011, only 30% of white evangelicals agreed with that statement. But by 2020, 68% agreed with that. And that's because Donald Trump really showed them that character doesn't matter. When it comes to the presidency, all that matters is the willingness to defend the tribe. However, you are quite correct that if Trump is indicted, this will just add to, I think, the bad odor in which he's held by those suburban swing voters who really do determine the outcome of the presidential elections. But just getting Donald Trump to the nomination of the Republican Party would increase the likelihood that he might be elected president anyway. We only have two choices in this system. And if people are pissed off enough at the Democrats, then they'll turn to the alternative, even if it is Donald Trump.
Jack Beatty, let me come to you on this question. I know this is highly speculative at this point, but chime in here. Is Donald Trump helped in the short term, the long term? What are you responding to as you listen to Jeff Cabaservis lay this out?
Well, I'm thinking of something Trump brayed, I guess you could use that verb, at the 2016 Republican convention. Hillary Clinton's slogan, you might remember, was, "I'm with her." Well, Trump looked at the delegates assembled and he said, "I'm with you." And the bond that Jeff is talking about with his voters is very deep. even though his grievances are personal and often even, you know, picayunely personal, and it is the voice of grievance that connects with them. It is the sense of they have of being left behind, left out of the national conversation, a sort of populist, right-wing populist backlash against elites and so on. So he's got that going for him, and that's money in the bank. It gets it could get him a nomination. Could it get him over the line? We don't know. But that would make that election among the most perilous in American history, because if Trump won, he has said, I will be your retribution. I will go after your... In other words, we're going to... He could take us a long way toward an authoritarian state if elected. So nominating him would be a... would be an ominous moment for American democracy.
And Jeff, when I look at polling around Trump, I'm sort of struck by two things. I'm looking at a recent Iowa poll. 46% of Republicans say they would definitely support him if he's the nominee. Now, that's a 21% drop since 2021. So that is an indication of just how weakened he is. On the other hand, polling shows that he's only running 3 or 4 points behind Joe Biden. So that suggests that the Democrats might have some work to do as well. Your thoughts on that?
Oh, I definitely think that we're in a situation where both parties are vulnerable because they have extremes that have unpopular positions. But it is also true that Americans, when they show up in the polling place, often tend to vote against rather than for. So I think, you know, it is a situation where I think it's unlikely that Donald Trump would be elected president again. I think highly likely that he would claim to have won the presidency, no matter the outcome. But I think it's a situation where the Democrats really do need to start thinking seriously about the threat that he presents and not, as some people do, claim that it would be easier to defeat Donald Trump and therefore Democrats might want him to be the Republican nominee.
Well, final thought here comes from Whit Ayers, a veteran Republican pollster, in terms of where we are with the possible indictment of Donald Trump, first time a former president faces that. I'm reading a quote from Whit Ayers. I have never studied the indictment of a former president and leading presidential candidate, and I've never done any polling on the indictment of a former president and leading presidential candidate, end quote. So that's the final sort of idea here. We are in new territory, never been here before. I want to thank my guests. Jeff Kabat-Service is the Vice President of Political Studies at the Niskanen Center. Jeff, thanks so much for joining us today. We appreciate it.
Well, thank you, Anthony.
As well, thanks to you, Jack Beatty, On Point News Analyst. Thank you, as always.
Thank you, Anthony.
On Monday, we're talking about national security concerns around the social media app TikTok. We want to hear about how you use TikTok. How much time do you spend on the app? Do you rely on TikTok to make a living, or does your business rely on it for marketing? How do you feel about the government wanting to potentially ban the app in the U.S.? Tell us by recording a message in the On Point Vox Pop app. If it's not on your phone already, just search for it, On Point Vox Pop, wherever you get your apps, or you can leave us a voicemail at 617-353-0683. Again, that number, 617-353-0683. Thanks for listening today. Have a great weekend. I'm Anthony Brooks. This is On Point.